Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. We have a great show today. We're going to dive right into the cloud. We're going to be talking about cloud banking and cloud fintech and sort of what's driving organizations to adapt. Even in traditional IT departments looking at cloud solutions for banks, what's driving that? We're going to get into that today. So we have joining us Howard Bovell. He's the head of IBM Hybrid Cloud Platform. Howard's responsible for the design, build, and operation of secure cloud services at IBM Hybrid Cloud and on collaboration platforms. Howard, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Delighted to be here, Brett. Thank you.
And we just discovered in the chit chat before in the green room, if you like, before we started this, that we're actually working on a project together for STC Pay, where Moovin is working on the front end, and you guys have built a hybrid cloud for them, right, out in Saudi.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. Great partnership.
Yeah, fantastic. So so tell me about the hybrid cloud division and specifically, your focus on financial services more recently. And then I'd like to bring in Judith from Promontory on the show as well.
Sure, yeah. So the if I can kind of start with the problem statement. So for regulated industries and in particular financial services, the kind of chapter one of cloud service providers was ill-suited to meet the needs of those industries. And there's a range of reasons for that, but not least of which is the fact that every single financial institution currently with other cloud service providers have to build in their compliance controls on a case-by-case basis. So it's like every bank has to kind of create its own version of electricity for it to run by. But then when a supervisory body would come in or a second or third line regulatory body internally, there will be inconsistency in terms of how the laws, rules, and regs are interpreted and therefore how they're applied. And that will cause a lot of actual risk and misunderstanding in the institutions. And Judith can talk a lot about that with the work that she does over at Promontory. But the problem then that we solve here at IBM is we build one single version of electricity or one single version of the compliance controls into our cloud so you can use it out of the box. So that helps de-risk the industry, but it also massively increases the time by which they can start to consume innovation.
Yeah, I mean, in the US, we're only really talking about 30% of banks that run their own tech stack, right? Because about 70% use not cloud, but they use the core systems platforms. I guess they're private clouds or enterprise clouds of a sort. But so are you mainly focusing on that, or are you doing multi-tenancy stuff?
Yeah, sure. So the actual cloud consumption in regulated industries is about 4%. So 96% of institutions manage and run their own applications. With an increasing number of third-party applications delivered in what's known as a software as a service context.
Right.
And the way that I think about it is if you're looking to improve the quality of the business that you have, the user experience, you need to actually deconstruct the business processes that you have. And a business process is made up of four components. It's made up of applications that you've touched upon, some of which are home built, others are purchased from third parties. The second element is the data and all of the issues associated around data, privacy, governance, ensuring that the provenance of that is correct, things such as CCAR calculations. The third area is the digital supply chain, so the software companies that you work with. And the fourth is people. And the problem that we're looking to solve for is to look at that holistically in terms of how we can help financial institutions digitize their processes, therefore offer a better user experience based upon the various markets they're addressing, but doing so in a way that actually helps address the laws, rules, and regulations they need to be adhering to, and therefore allow them to go more quickly whilst being in control.
But from a regulatory perspective, it's really not an issue anymore in terms of implementing on the cloud, is there? We've got through most of those hurdles, right?
It varies around various jurisdictions. So regulators do have general guidelines around the consumption of infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, and software as a service. But they do have concerns around business continuity and resiliency. Right. So how can you ensure that your business processes can operate in the event of a catastrophic failure, whatever that may be?
Right.
Legitimately, they also have concerns around supply chain in terms of how do you know that your supply chain also can ensure the quality of that business process. More recently, there's been an issue with a company called SolarWinds that has penetrated most of the world's companies through a cyber hack. And how, as a financial institution, can you legislate to ensure that those kind of issues can't arise in your processes and therefore cause service disruption or systemic risk to the industry?
Well, on that note, let's invite Judith Pinto into the discussion. Judith is the Managing Director at Promontory. She advises clients on information security, business risk, continuity planning, regulatory compliance, and general operational issues. Judith, you work more on the implementation side of this. Are you seeing more readiness now after the pandemic in respect to sort of the whole drive to digital transformation and that, and cloud being closely associated with that?
Yeah, thanks, Brett. Yeah, absolutely. I think the pandemic placed banks under pressure to innovate, especially in the retail space, because they needed to change their model as they had to close retail operations, at the beginning of the pandemic. And so we saw a lot of institutions looking to innovate pretty quickly to meet customer demand online versus, face-to-face. And so we're also seeing, organizations taking advantage of that to partner with, as Howard had mentioned earlier, fintechs to provide more creative solutions, solutions for their clients because they're demanding.
And you can't do partnerships with fintech unless you're cloud ready, right?
Correct. It's really challenging to connect your mainframe to a fintech. We're seeing consumers, demanding more innovation from their financial institutions because they're seeing this innovation in other parts of their lives, right. Their online presence.
Yeah, no, I'd absolutely agree with that. That's, if you look at Amazon's Q4 results, what was it, about $100 billion in sales in Q4 alone? It's insane, so digitization is certainly big and happening. All right, so Howard, despite all of this digitization effort and the impact of COVID and closing branches like Judith has spoken about, there's still some banks that are hesitant to make the move to the cloud. Why do you think that is?
There's a range of reasons. It's not a trivial exercise to move your applications off your computers to somebody else's. And very often the promises of cost reduction actually don't materialize because of the way that banks operate in terms of the controls they have to build in, as I mentioned at the beginning of the call, in terms of having to do that on a case-by-case basis. But the other issue as well is that for companies like Amazon and Amazon.com, but also companies that were born in the cloud, it's far more straightforward because you've actually built your applications to work entirely in the cloud. Banks have a huge amount of legacy environments, and some of those legacy environments serve them really well. And that's why the philosophy that I had in my old role when I worked in financial services and the philosophy that I brought to IBM is the world will be hybrid cloud. You'll have on-premise applications and data sets and off-premise, but you need to ensure that they operate and integrate in a seamless fashion. Otherwise, actually, in this age of instant gratification, where customers actually will prioritize ease of use very often over the product will become second. Unless you can get those points of integration correctly working properly, you actually cause more friction in the actual process as opposed to less.
Now, in reality, though, I don't imagine that most customers would actually care. They probably don't even know. I mean, these are customers that are using, these days we've got Robinhood and the Cash App and, all this other stuff we're using, which is clearly in the cloud. But I don't think necessarily customers equate, what sort of tech stack, that a fintech has versus what a bank has. They just assume it's all, secure banking, right?
That's absolutely correct. And it should be, the technology should be invisible to the actual consumer, but the benefits of it should be evident in terms of how easy it is to work with the actual financial institution, whether they were born in the cloud, such as a Robinhood, or whether they're actually a more legacy financial institution. But cloud has enabling capabilities, if used properly, that actually can make that experience far more frictionless and seamless.
I do think there's a good argument there, Howard, because as you said, there's a very strong correlation between customer experience, particularly in sort of UX design and all of the advancements we've seen coming out of fintech that are on cloud native companies. So, you know, there is a good argument that they are operating at scale. They've grown very quickly. In most cases, they operate they operate more efficiently financially as well, make greater margin per customer. And, let's say it, cloud is these days safer than most a lot of on-premise solutions, right?
Equivalent, if it's an established financial institution, because of all the checks and balances, the actual cybersecurity capabilities will be better on-premise than off-premise with current cloud service providers. There's a parity of control to the IBM cloud because we've actually built these controls in place from the very beginning. So in the same way as perhaps Amazon's been around for 12 years, it's dealing with its legacy because the cloud that it built was for purely companies that were building on the cloud and didn't have the same regulatory overheads. The cloud we built here at IBM over the past 2 years has built these controls in place, so they're embedded in there. So it's a newer architecture, it's more contemporary, but it's entirely relevant for regulated industries. The point you make, though, around the cloud native companies that have got an ability to scale out more quickly, their economics are in a better position, and are all completely correct. But as you know, within this industry, it's about actually the ecosystem that you bring together. So it's all the different partners that you work with within financial institutions that create the overall experience, but also the overall offering. And having that ability to seamlessly connect in a very secure and compliant way is critical. And that's the solution that we put forward and what we built here.
Okay. Maybe, Judith, this is one for you, but, how are organizational structures changing as a result of, this type of fintech collaboration and cloud and so forth? How does that change the skill sets of your average bank? Are you finding new competencies that they're having to learn?
Oh, absolutely. You hear the phrase upskilling used quite a bit as organizations look to not only take advantage of the technologies that a lot of the fintechs are providing, but also to take advantage of cloud. It's a different skill set than managing sort of your, on-prem network. And so we're seeing a lot of organizations, the larger organizations, being more successful in that because they have the financial resources to hire the talent to do that or to pay for the training to upskill. We're seeing a bigger challenge in the smaller institutions that don't have the draw and don't have the resources that the large banks have. And so we are seeing, sort of a divide happening. And that's one of the things we wanted to tackle with this solution is to provide a sort of safe space, a safe landing space for these institutions to partner with these fintechs and with these software as a service providers.
And it's a key point you raise there, Brad, as well, which is very often actually changing technology is not trivial. Changing the silicon is not trivial, but it's a hell of a lot easier than it is changing the carbon, the people. And that's very often where these technology transformation programs go wrong, which is they leave behind the cultural soul of their own organization by not actually skilling the people that they have working for them to move into the new space. And therefore you need to do both transformations at the same time. And also very often companies will look at the skills of somebody based upon the job they currently do and almost kind of have this iceberg situation where they miss 90% of the experience and the skills that person has in what they've done in previous roles. So it's very important to do a detailed evaluation of the people that you have, their skills, experience, not just in their current role, but what they've done previously, and then give them the appropriate resources through assignments to fill out their experience or through educational programs. So they're as equally change hungry as the new technology that you roll out.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's when you come to partnering with fintechs, that's obviously part of the problem is the fintechs can come in and tend to sort of say, well, we're going to show you how it's done in the 21st century. And, you know, and not necessarily, there's a bit of a culture clash there between, you know, these guys who, you know, have spent 20 years investing in a, you know, a on-prem IT solution as an example. So, you know, Judith, you mentioned that you've actually been using this to bring fintechs and banks together. So talk about that culture, that meeting of the culture between those two different styles of organizations.
Yeah, well, you know, I was smiling when you were talking about fintechs because typically your fintechs aren't as concerned about controls as a traditional financial institution is. And so the solution we've built out, and Howard touched on this at the beginning, is really to focus on de-risking the environment. And one of the challenges from a regulatory perspective is the oversight of your, you know, third and fourth parties and understanding whether they've implemented the security controls in the same way that you have. So the idea was to, you know, provide this environment where those security controls were on, and those institutions, those, you know, fintechs and software as a service providers are adopting those same controls. So you don't have to worry about whether or not that they're maintaining your security requirements because they're operating in this environment.
In that operating environment. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. What are some of the other challenges apart from culture that you see in sort of doing this, these types of projects, Judith?
I think, you know, culture we talked about, but it's also the pace of change. I think organizations are challenged because they're larger. They can't operate as quickly. There are a lot more, you know, checks and balances in place. And I think, you know, helping speed up that process by automating as much as possible is key.
Howard, when you, you know, are sitting in front of a board of banks or, you know, a team that's deciding on this technology, how do you describe the benefits they're going to get out of using, you know, using sort of a hybrid cloud, you know, and in terms of their extensibility with partnerships and so forth?
Yeah, I think you actually kind of summed it up quite nicely around the customer perspective a little bit earlier in the show where you said that the customer doesn't really care about what technology it's on. So when I have spoken to kind of boards, board members and chief executives, it's about understanding what the actual business value is that you're delivering. Because applying technology purely for technology's sake is a science project as opposed to anything that can deliver any material benefit for their shareholders or for their customers. And there's been a lot of hype and there still is a lot of hype around what cloud can do. But it's an enabling capability amongst others that actually drive the business value, the scale-out capability that you talked about, the more frictionless customer experiences, if done correctly. So I always kind of start the conversation in terms of starting where the customer currently is and what they have. So those legacy environments. And then being very clear in terms of what's the business outcomes that they want to drive. So is it better operating leverage in terms of the unit cost of digital transactions reduces? Is it better availability because it needs to be a high performance process? Is it around connecting for securities and clearing the whole community of other providers? So therefore, how do you think about doing that in a secure fashion? So the context of the question always needs to be couched in a business problem basis. And then the actual solutions to it then can actually come from that situation, that context.
Yep. So Judith, do you think the banks are keeping up with this, given that, you know, it has, like, 2020 has been quite a year in terms of digital adoption. And, you know, as you both said, it was a bit of a surprise for some of these organizations that thought they had more time. So how do banks keep up, Judith?
No, I think they are. And you know, the challenge is also keeping up with the regulations and the requirements. So, you know, having the capabilities in-house to continue to monitor for regulatory change and determine how that impacts, you know, the technology strategy, how that impacts their control environment, how that impacts their operating models. I think that, you know, some of the smaller institutions are more challenged in that space. You know, again, we've been trying to tackle that sort of ecosystem problem. But the larger institutions have kept pace fairly well. I was, you know, talking with a client last week, and they were actually surprised how they were able to accelerate some of their digital transformation during the time of the pandemic.
The other issue, of course, is that the large banks are a source of capital and liquidity, huge capital sources and huge liquidity sources, and the fintechs kind of feed off that capital.
Oh, no, it can be very complementary for sure.
So therefore, the pace of acceleration that a fintech will do, where sometimes they'll make a misstep, as we've recently seen with some of the equity trading platforms, is de-risked by the larger institutions. And therefore, you can get your business model slightly wrong and therefore have to make some course corrections because of some behaviors that you wouldn't perhaps have seen previously. That can then get underwritten with margin calls and so on by other institutions. So it's just getting that right calibration across the whole financial services ecosystem in terms of the pace of innovation and the pace of innovation around particular types of business models underwritten by larger institutions that can carry the burden.
So Judith, you mentioned these regulations and compliance controls and meeting certain requirements. Is that requirements from an IT security perspective, or is it, you know, what else are you indicating has a sort of regulatory purview when it comes to what sort of type of cloud I deploy?
Yeah, no, I was referring to sort of the IT compliance perspective.
Right.
And for large global institutions, it's, you know, a challenge to keep, you know, your hands on everything that's happening in all of the jurisdictions in which you operate. That being said, there are business level requirements as well, as, you know, a lot of the workload is looking to move to the cloud. And so it's important to ensure that those compliance requirements are still met. As you know, banks look to transform, you know, their operations.
Absolutely. Now, Howard, you know, we've got new technologies coming out all the time that are deployed on the basis of cloud infrastructure. You know, you've got autonomous vehicles that are going to be using cloud. You've got, you know, smart glasses, augmented reality, you know, head-up displays and things like that that Apple and Facebook will probably be launching in the next couple of years. A lot of this technology is going to be in the cloud. And so for banks to have their utility integrated into this technology layer, won't all banks need to be on the cloud in the future?
There'll be a need for being a hybrid state, but I guess the unit of currency in the points that you've outlined there is the data. So all those digital devices are sources for data that can then be used to be monetized. There's this notion that if you're not paying for the product, you are the product based upon the data that you provide to the actual digital platform. So banks need to be in that flow for the monetization of that data by the companies that will be monetizing that data. But also there's opportunities for banks as well to actually get further insights from the data sets that they have based upon interactions and transactions.
And maybe sell it in an aggregate or something, right?
Or commingle it and then use it in a particular the way they want to do that. Now, I suspect many banks don't want to sell data, but many banks will want to improve the quality of the service they provide. And they can do that by getting different data sets to provide them insights. But the key piece is to do that in the most confidential way. And again, that's been built into the IBM Financial Services Cloud, which is this notion of confidential compute, where we do some absolutely amazing things around encryption that no other company does, born out of the very well-invested and well-resourced research labs that we would have within IBM. And that allows them to commingle data, but in such a way that it can never be corrupted. The provenance of that data can never be corrupted. Think of it as a kind of a periodic table with different elements where you need to ensure that the elements are correct so that you get the right alloy from the actual commingling of them.
I want to get sci-fi with you guys a little bit here. Let's think 10 years out. So, you know, 10 years out and we've got embedded artificial intelligence capabilities like personal AI assistants and, you know, banking is sort of just built into the framework of your life and able to act as a financial coach and help you manage your bills and deliver your credit in real time. You know, what do you think the financial sector looks like in terms of its makeup, you know, in terms of tech giants working in the space versus incumbent banks that have digitally transformed versus, you know, specialist fintechs?
I think you kind of look back in history to then look forward in the future. So the size of your balance sheet and therefore the capital and liquidity that you can provide will determine whether you're a meaningful global financial institution, and then all the risk measures that you put in there, the risk calculations. There's been large companies in the past that weren't necessarily from a financial services heritage that went into financial services because of their balance sheet. And case after case, they start to pull back out because that wasn't their area of core competence. The financial
integrity. Unless they're ant financial out of China.
Different, entirely different economic model,
yes.
In terms of where they're coming from. So difficult to translate that, but that may be the pervasive means of statehood in 10 years' time.
I put my neck on the line with that one in Bank 4.0, and I said that Ant was going to be the largest financial institution in the world by 2030. So I'm gunning for Ma to get the IPO done.
Let's hope that goes through. So it's all about liquidity sources and capital and the ability to manage that risk. Absolutely, financial services is embedded almost invisibly. It'd be like the point you made, Brett, on people don't care about whether it's on a cloud or whether it's on whatever. I guess increasingly the financial element being embedded into everything that we do in a seamless fashion is what the future looks like. And the liquidity sources could actually be masked by the primary company that's looking to derive value from that data set.
So I can see this working for a bunch of other industries as well, particularly the healthcare sector.
Absolutely. In terms of the regulatory capabilities that we do, obviously your health records are your unit of currency, which you want to keep very, very private. We build specific capabilities for that part of the industry on our confidential compute platforms. Mm-hmm. And there's the migration from the legacy environments to the new environments. It's a very fragmented marketplace. If we think financial services is a large ecosystem, healthcare is even more so, with a lot of bureaucracy and therefore a lot of opportunity to actually digitize those processes.
Absolutely. Good input. Yeah. So, all right, guys, we're running up on the clock here. So before we close out on this episode, first of all, let me ask, where can listeners find out more about Hybrid Cloud if we've got a bank, a community bank or credit union or something listening and they want to get in on the action? What do they do?
IBM.com. a lot of resources there you can download. I with an I, B, B.
Now you're just being clever. Yes. All right. We could probably tweet that out on our social media.
That's super.
Channel thanks. Ourselves too. So, Judith, what about yourself? Do you have a Twitter ID or something that we can, or a LinkedIn profile?
Absolutely. And then promontory.com as well. You can find some resources there that we have co-authored with Howard and team.
And do you use your personal Twitter account to engage?
I don't tweet, but I'm on LinkedIn.
All right. What about you, Howard?
I do as well. So it's at Howard Bourville for Twitter. And we can provide.
That's B-O-V-I-L-L-E?
That's right, yes.
Okay, great. Fantastic. Well, hey, thanks, guys. It's been really interesting. I'm a big believer in the hybrid cloud stuff. If banks are, wanting to take a general step into this technology rather than, but if they're going to compete with fintechs, or they're going to collaborate with fintechs, or they're going to collaborate with big tech players, they're going to now need to be cloud competent. So great information to get us deep into this topic. Thank you, Howard Bourville and Judith Pinto, for joining Breaking Banks.
Thank you, Brett.
Thanks, Brett.
Okay, guys, just coming up on a break, and after the break, we'll have more goodness on Breaking Banks. We'll be right back with you shortly. IBM Cloud for Financial Services is uniquely designed to help financial institutions and their ecosystem partners unlock the promise of public cloud and accelerate the pace of innovation without compromising security or regulatory compliance. IBM Cloud for Financial Services has been designed with the demands of some of the world's largest and most complex organizations in mind. It uses the same cryptographic technology that financial institutions already rely on today. Data that a client stores in IBM Cloud belongs to that client and can only be accessed by them. Clients can bring their own key that no one else can see, not even IBM, and can build and run core business applications and workloads with single dashboard visibility and multi-platform portability. IBM Cloud provides end-to-end data encryption with extensive control, workload-centric security by default, and IBM Cloud Security and Compliance Center.
The Breaking Banks Europe podcast brings you European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders all innovating in the rapidly evolving fintech scene.
Hi, I'm Matteo Rizzi.
I am Ajit Tripathi.
This is Matthias Kröner.
I'm Megan Johnson.
I am Paolo Sironi.
I'm Nina Mohanty. Join us and some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in fintech as we bring you insights into European fintech. Find us wherever you normally listen to your podcasts or at provoke.fm.
Judy Samuelson joins me today. Judy is founder and executive director of the Aspen Institute Business and Society Program. She's a former banker, and she previously ran a $100 million portfolio of loans and investments at the Ford Foundation, structured to encourage banks and insurance companies to co-invest in community-based economic development. She writes regularly for Courts at Work. She's a Bellagio Fellow at the Rockefeller Foundation and a director of the Financial Health Network. Her new book is The Six New Rules of Business, Creating Real Value in a Changing World. Judy, welcome to the show, and tell us, why did you write this book?
I wrote the book because I've been on this journey for a long time now, over two decades, trying to piece together the puzzle of kind of this extraordinary role of corporations in the world and kind of what needs to be true for business to be at the table with society really at the center of their thinking and applying their extraordinary reach and talent and capacity, distribution systems, problem-solving skills to the issues that we're all troubled with, but also we're bound to the success of business if we get it right. So I really kind of leaning into my knowledge of business at this point, having worked with it pretty intensively since I started this program at the Aspen Institute. But then also seeing these things unfold that I think are really driving the change. I wanted to tell the story of that, but also signal some of the blind spots that I think are holding us back.
Well, and the book and much of your life's work is really kind of a counterpoint to the Milton Friedman and others who have long held that the purpose of a corporation is to maximize profit for shareholders, period, and a fairly narrow view of corporate responsibility. And you really have a much expanded worldview. How did you come about that worldview?
I think a lot of it is, well, part of it is I'm passionate about kind of this intersection of business and society and believe deeply that our best business leaders and our future business leaders increasingly get this complicated equation. But I also, it's through the power of observation. You know, there's no business that survives for a very long period of time that can work with a single objective function. You know, we're talking about mostly businesses that we consult with or work with or support. These are massive enterprises, whether they're U.S. or they're global, tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of employees operating in vastly different environments in the U.S. and around the world. You know, take a company like Pepsi, Lay's potato chips. I mean, they touch, tens of thousands of potato farmers. That's one tiny piece of their complex supply chain. So I believe that if we observe business, the ones that we admire, but also that simply survive, of course, have to manage to a whole complexity of different inputs and outputs. And managing to that is essentially what the purpose of the corporation is. Businesses serve many purposes. Shareholder primacy, or kind of Milton Friedman-esque thinking, it works maybe in classrooms, and we're trying to sort things through and talk about a theory or an ideal state, but we're in the, we're down in the bowels of what actually happens in business. And it's very clear that businesses serve many purposes, but also that purpose is revealed by their actions.
Well, kind of my rudimentary personal philosophy is that the free market solves a lot of problems pretty well over the long run, but doesn't solve every problem, doesn't solve them all perfectly, and certainly not over the short run. I mean, we don't have to look any further than the deregulated energy markets in Texas over the last few weeks to see some examples about that. Is it an oversimplification to just say that, well, what you're really saying is this is just a lack of long-term thinking on the behalf of so many leaders today?
Actually, I don't think that's an oversimplification. For many years, we found that the best way to engage the conversation was around the need to curb short-termism, extend time horizons, amplify the voice of long-term investors. I'll tell a quick story. I remember, I haven't had a chance to tell the story in a long time. I thought it'd end up in the book, but it didn't. I remember my father was, at that point, probably 80 years old. This is many years ago. And he's now been gone for over a decade. And he was driving me to the airport. I'd been out to visit him and my mother in San Diego. And he was driving me down to the airport after a nice long weekend. And he said, "Now, what is this new thing you're doing again?" And I had 35 miles to try to explain this. And I kind of was going on, all this hackneyed language around corporate responsibility and business and what we need to be thinking about. And, and he just kind of said, he had been with Pacific Telephone and then AT&T for many years. And he said, "Aren't you just trying to say they ought to take a long-term view?" And I remember going, oh my God, that light bulb went off. And I said, that's exactly what we're trying to say. Because that's where the lines converge. If you're thinking, regardless of what it is, whether you're thinking about the consequences of business actions on a certain labor pool or the rules of engagement in kind of the health of communities on which you're dependent, or clearly the complex questions around climate and species and natural resources. It's the lines, it's taking the long-term view, you start to see where these things converge. And if you're dealing in the short term of now, it's pretty easy to externalize those ideas and thoughts and realities. But that's where it all comes together.
Well, there's an old saying, explain it to me like I'm five, and maybe we should say, explain it to me like I'm your father and with a half hour drive to the airport.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Instead, yeah. He just explained it to me is the way that worked, right?
Well, and you are also a former banker and worked on Wall Street. Financial markets are clearly a part of the short-termism. I mean, how much did you have in mind the financial services industry as you were writing the book?
Well, I certainly didn't have the financial industry as I knew it. I was a real banker. I wasn't really a Wall Street type. I was, walking the streets in the garment center of lower Midtown. And so I was really dealing with smaller importers and exporters and manufacturers at the time. But I started to certainly see then the influence of kind of the financialization of our economy and how the bank that I was at, Bankers Trust Company at the time, started seeing, that they could make more money on the kind of trading of the credit than actually the original transaction. And so that may have entered my thinking, but through years of dialogue and engagement and the opportunity to work with change agents who are really leaning into these kind of questions around the role of corporations and the role of society and where they intersect, it becomes really clear that it's really the businesses that have the real agency here. They're the ones, the issuers, the corporations, they're the ones that have the most at stake. The financial services is representing a complex market in and of themselves, but shareholders, if we use that one terminology, shareholders are they're certainly not all the same. They're not a monolithic group. And those who invest on their behalf are being rewarded in certain ways. And that doesn't present as much opportunity for, it's changed some, but the real action is inside these companies where they are they are required to make a lot of complex trade-offs and to manage through, as I was saying before, a very complicated set of realities and inputs in order to make a product that lasts, to attract and retain talent, to in order to engage customers well and to, you know, create valuable goods and services. That's just a complicated endeavor. And the kind of Wall Street side of it is flatter. And so it's definitely present, and the pressures that Wall Street brings to bear are a real phenomenon for public companies in particular. So that's where it comes into fray. And oftentimes what you're really doing is trying to steal the ability of the company to resist some of those pressures and to do it, to succeed at doing so.
Well, those pressures are real. And that was why I asked about the short term versus long term, because, you know, it's one thing to say, look, there's a lot of things that we should probably just be better, you know, citizens of planet Earth about. And the flip side of that is you can understand an argument that says, yeah, that's great, but my shareholders have hired me to be a steward of this organization here. And that can appear to be a bigger conflict than I think it really needs to be, because if we are proper stewards of the planet and our society and everything else, that means we're creating a better environment to run this business, you know, for which we're acting as steward. And I think maybe there's not quite as many conflicts as we would like to think for ourselves.
Yeah, and increasingly we are getting a lot more noise out of the kind of capital, you know, environment in terms of all of those shareholders that are speaking to their own desire to have, you know, the world work differently. You know, I've got a sign on my wall that says, I cannot have a successful business in a failed society. It is that simple. Society is, you know, business is fully dependent on society in myriad ways. And we've entered a period of time where I think that, you know, there is real intention that's been set around operating in the longer term public interest. But it's also true that capital is no longer a scarce resource. You know, one of the things I write about is one of the rules is that it's culture, which is a scarce resource today, not capital. And it's we've never quite been in this period before when, you know, General Motors and was at the top of the, you know, the tables. You know, there were a million employees and there were, you know, they had, you know, exhaustive need for capital to grow, to build, you know, the bricks and mortar plants and all of that was needed in order to produce their product. But that world's changed. You know, our largest companies are tech. They operate, you know, their intellectual property, these kind of intangible assets are their most important values and are most important contributors to long-term value. And they're capital light. You know, a lot of companies go public that don't even need additional capital. They're just giving an exit to their original investors. And certainly, as Marjorie Kelly, as I write about it in the book, you know, who wrote The Divine Right of Capital, reminds us, you got your money at the IPO. Why do we burn up so much time and effort thinking about shareholders that are really an aftermarket and technically do not own the company? They own shares of stock with limited rights, important rights, but limited rights. And, you know, let's back to this long-term vision. What matters most?
Well, and in that same chapter, you contrasted that with the story of Spotify, who went to great lengths to do a direct listing and talk about how the leadership team at Spotify really thought about capital markets much differently than maybe we used to.
Well, they didn't need capital. And so they made very clear that they looked at this as a utility, you know, that the stock market was a utility that would, they certainly respected and understood that, you know, there's rules of engagement regardless, but it wasn't what was animating the company. And, you know, the CEO of Spotify and other companies are quite clear that they understand today, and this is probably in some respects always been the case, this isn't why employees don't get out of bed in the morning to make a lot more money for the shareholder. They get out of bed in the morning because they're interested, if they're great employees, they're really interested in the product and the service and the and, you know, the opportunity to do something useful. And this is increasingly evident with younger employees that have, who kind of don't draw clear lines between, you know, work and home, certainly not in this environment anyway, and who are intently committed to making sure that the company is actually mirroring those things that they hold dear. And we see this in the relationship between employees and CEOs, that that's changing. And so I think it's one of those examples where the rules have already shifted. And what this book is about is hoping to enable people to kind of catch up with the change and make sure we see clearly those forces, these irreversible forces that are defining how business thinks and acts today.
Well, and in that same chapter, you called out one of my favorite business school cases, the Tylenol poisoning crisis in 1982. And the company, you know, kind of unusually, yet it shouldn't be, really focused on doing the right thing and communicating and taking the millions of dollars of product off the shelf quickly. And you talked about that wasn't shocking to you because they wrote a credo 39 years prior to that, 1943, that could have been written yesterday in terms of this view of long-term view and the need to take care of a wider perspective beyond just shareholders in the short term.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, it was written yesterday. If you look at the structure of the Business Roundtable's restatement of the purpose of the corporation that came out August 19th, 2019, you know, it pretty closely follows the credo. And that should not be surprising, I guess, because Alex Gorsky, the CEO of J&J today, was chairing the corporate governance kind of task force and committee that step back with the Business Roundtable to say, maybe it's time to take a fresh look at what we say about the corporation and its purpose. And so I think that I assume that the J&J credo, which was the kind of document that was the real touchstone and enabled J&J to fairly rapidly make a very, very difficult decision and kind of end up on the right side of the equation in time.
Well, you're starting to hit on some of the things why I was curious if you had thought about financial services a lot in writing this book, even though we've already talked about a couple of companies outside of the industry. You know, all of what we just discussed was under one of your six rules, which is culture is king and talent rules. And I love the way you've structured the book because you also lay out what was the old rule and what are the drivers for change from that old rule to the new rule. And you called out the old rule when capital, what happens when capital is no longer scarce, because the old rule is capital is king and shareholders rule. You bring up the roundtable, the business roundtable, and you know, you talked about that recently on the Emerge Everywhere podcast with Jen Tesher. So I don't want to kind of repeat that whole conversation, but somebody also involved with that was Jamie Dimon, chairman of JPMorgan Chase, and he pretty enthusiastically embraced this change as well. What was it that you think made the Business Roundtable ready for this kind of really dramatic change?
I think, again, they're catching up to where the puck has gone. you know, we don't, the Business Roundtable had a different statement, decades before in the kind of era of Milton Friedman.
Right.
The idea that, and when these ideas took hold, you know, this idea that we could focus on shareholder and over the, and the intention was long-term. I think that was the intention. You know, we kind of turbocharged that idea when we started paying executives in stock. And so that's kind of a derivative story here, but it's one that brings capital markets into this picture pretty clearly. So, you know, Jamie Dimon manages a massive enterprise. He has his own employees. He can see the way the world is shaping up in terms of the complexity of issues that their clients, both people that invest, come to, JP Morgan for business credit and services, but also high net worth individuals and the ways in which they're trying to resolve the kinds of things that they care about and their financial picture and their intentions in that respect. You know, he's alert to these things. And when, you know, the Business Roundtable kind of started really working on this, they found that, I think that the world had moved on. But they found that their own members were also saying that it's time for us to kind of state more clearly the complexity of the challenge and the importance of us getting this right in order to secure the license to operate and assure that we're that we begin to try to restore trust, which in business, which has been harmed by, you know, I think decades of kind of too much focus on the shareholder at the risk of everybody else. You know, it's important to remember that in this period of time, over these last decades, over 90% of profits have been returned to shareholders versus, you know, that's a small retention for employees, for
reinvestment,
contractors, reinvestment, the kind of infrastructure that you need to build, you know, continuing to innovate around intellectual property, all of those things that you know that a real long-term oriented company is doing in order to stay alive and continue to thrive. And so I think it's, you know, capital markets are a part of this puzzle, and it's a massive part of our economy. It's an important piece of what we're training people for in business schools. So that kind of way of thinking about simplistic but kind of narrow measurement of business success, you know, focusing on, as I said before, kind of a single objective function and wishing we could just stay at the level of just trying to measure this piece, the firm and what does it represent, and maybe avoid having to think about the complex supply chain and the complex relationships that, of course, businesses always had to manage too. And so it's kind of like, take it from the classroom and let's apply it at JP Morgan Chase. Nope, it's not working that way anymore.
Well, and, you know, clearly we're in an era where you've mentioned complexity a couple of times, right? It's increasingly complex and interrelated in the global economy. And we have, unrest in various parts of society around the world and in our own country here in the U.S. And kind of to your last point that it might, CEOs might want to be able to try to cordon that off and say, well, but that's not my focus. I only have to focus on the company here. Increasingly, it's harder for them to do so. And what we've talked about so far is kind of that self-realization or maybe some collective realization. But the other thing that makes things happen is laws and rules, too. Are we heading into an era where some of this becomes more codified in the legal system as well?
I actually am not sure we are, or that there won't be unintended consequences if we think is the only strategy for getting us out of this. Obviously, sign me up. Let's get a price on carbon. I mean, I think that kind of clarity is important, and business would be among the first to say we'd rather get this price and figure out where we're going than live in the uncertainty of now. So I think there are domains where, you know, for God's sakes, let's get a reasonable federal minimum wage. What does that look like? What's the time frame? Are there exceptions? All of those things are place specific. They may be there may be industries that would argue that, you know, we're approaching it a different way, and, you know, you know, Amazon is now advertising everybody should be paying at least $15 an hour. So obviously the conversation has changed a lot, but it's changed a lot because we're starting to hear back so vociferously in the case of, you know, for example, a minimum wage from the people that probably have the greatest accountability now for the behavior of business, and that's employees. Employees are going to be much closer to the action than kind of generic rules from government. And it's not that I certainly understand the intersection between, you know, private action and public action here. Yes, of course, we need to raise the bar to assure that we have a minimum standard. But if you start to really think about the complexity of what you're managing to here, none of that is going to get resolved fully by law. I think we do have an opportunity to raise the bar in some important domains, but we're always going to see the situation where the companies who have the most at risk here, because either their brand is exposed or the nature of the business, may be the one who is most motivated to raise the bar in its industry. And it's not usually because there's a law that they're trying to jump over. It's because of the nature of the beast and the business they're operating and the various publics that they need to resolve and kind of relationships that they need to resolve within the supply chain to continue to be an excellent producer or supplier of goods and services. And that happens time and again, that we see a company kind of say, you know, it really makes sense for me to take this first move and to raise the bar on an industry and see where we need to go then. And I think that continues to drive change. And, you know, obviously we're in a moment where with a change in administration where we are going to see new law, and that's important to do as well. But it doesn't take business agency out of the picture.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you talked about employees, and that's another one of your new rules. Employees give voice to risk and competitive advantage. And that's in contrast to the old rule where labor is a cost to be minimized. It doesn't feel like that's an old rule. The rule feels like that rule is still very much in effect, especially as we're in a growing gig economy, as you know, people are staying in their homes and expecting others who are most often contractors to come and bring things to them. What has to change besides minimum wage laws? How do we really give businesses the incentive to think more about employees as important players in the role of business?
I think we've had some real wake-up calls in the last months. It is really remarkable seeing these advertisements. I kept on running to them on, you know, Google searches in the last 2 days, with Amazon saying that they are calling for the federal government to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. You know, I'm sure it's more complex than that, even at Amazon. But we've seen, you know, clearly the reason Amazon is doing this is because their employees are organizing. And in their case, they are, at this point today, offering employees $2,000 in order to leave if they want to, rather than stay and fight within a union. Google employees walked out over Me Too incidents in the last, you know, 18 months. Again, Amazon employees organized around the company's failure to meet the bar that they wanted to see on climate change. We've seen employees activate on the decision to serve certain kinds of contracts that they were not happy with, whether it was with ICE or with the Defense Department. Employees are taking action in lots of different ways. Google employees, 220 Google employees stepped out and said that they had been organizing an employee union over the last year. What's different is that this is not, it's kind of not the employee of yore. You know, they're leaning in on a set of different questions. Certainly their own, in some cases, it's about their own welfare, but they're also looking at the welfare of contractors that they may share a cubicle with, but, you know, could use the extra support that they know that they get as employees, and they see this as an unfair situation. We see them leaning in on all these different questions. I say just watch this space. Yes, they're a cost of operation. Yes, companies are still desperate to try to figure out how to make sure that they think that they're optimizing. But, you know, we're not taking advantage of those who are closest to the ground and are closest to understanding in this complex world, both the risks and the opportunities, without engaging with employees in a really generative way. And I think we are starting to see some of that change take place.
Well, we're in an era now of record low membership in labor unions. Do you think, does that change or does it manifest itself in some other way?
We're also seeing companies in experiment with new ways to try to bring employee voice to the table. We've got our own project underway at the Aspen Institute, what we call a Worker Voice Lab, where we're bringing together a group of 20 people from different walks of life to kind of generate good ideas about how do you bring in employee voice, both in governance as well as in the operations of the company. And some new ideas are being generated, but we're also seeing things like companies that use something called a mirror board, where they create kind of a intermediary structure that helps the that they can design to make sure that they're listening to voices that may not be as easy to kind of hear in the cacophony of running an operation. There's obviously a lot of interest in understanding how models work in other countries where employees have been involved in boards. Is that going to be the methodology we use in the United States? Highly unlikely based on how much antipathy there is toward that idea. But I think there's a lot of other ways in which you could structure conversation or kind of restructure the role of some of the board committees to make sure that we're being attuned to the health of the enterprise. I think that a major change here is that we have in the structure of incentives and rewards, we tend to look at these senior executives who are being paid significant amounts of money and think that the thing we need to do is make sure that they're making as much money as some other CEO of some other enterprise and, you know, not even necessarily in the same industry. Today, it's really about the health of the enterprise itself. And that change is happening fairly rapidly. You know, CEOs are heads of communities of interest. Employees are empowered because of the you know, architecture of the internet and the ability to use, you know, everything from Google Docs to, you know, Outlook Teams to, you know, or Microsoft Teams to be able to communicate better and to manage. They know how to work together as employees. We've certainly finessed this during, you know, COVID time here. And those tools are being brought to bear to amplify employee voice and to kind of give air to things that employees see differently. And so I think we're just in an interesting era where we don't know exactly where this is going, but I think it's a harbinger of something that's really important.
Well, your book certainly has big ideas and big ambitions. How far along do you think we are from realizing some of the ideals that you've set out? And maybe most importantly, what should CEOs be thinking about on their 2021 agenda to be able to make progress on these things?
Well, I do think it's about listening and within, but also, you know, thinking about the diversity of interest that are natural kind of allies for the enterprise that is thinking deeply about not only the consequences of inaction, but the potential to really show some leadership on some questions that simply need to head in the right direction in order for business to be operating in a healthy environment. And I think, you know, I think our best leaders are going to be leaning into these questions. The Business Roundtable, another thing that happened in the last year is that they landed a, you know, profound statement on climate change. Hadn't touched it for many years. I think over 15 years since they had put out anything in that domain. So I think we're starting to see business leaders coalesce not just around the things that we assume that they always talk about, taxes low and regulations, you know, few and far between if possible. They really are starting to see the kind of nature of a relationship between business and society that's going to simply have to resolve in a better way. And so I think the best leaders are already equipped to be thinking that way. We've certainly seen a lot of innovation in including in the fintech domain. I mean, companies like PayPal, companies like Salesforce that have been keen to better understand the condition of the employees in terms of equitable wages, in terms of whether or not their own employees are in healthy enough financial situation to be able to really thrive on the job. Those kinds of inquiries start inside because that's where the natural relationships to best explore some of these questions reside. So I think we're in a really interesting period of time. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of employees use their voice on questions that simply would have felt like that is not inside my, that's not part of my day job. That's not part of our what I ought to be commenting on as a business. And that those kind of days are over. We're seeing employees weigh in, or employers, CEOs weigh in on a bunch of questions that may feel a little bit hard to tackle, but are very much present in this kind of complex relationship and web of connections between a healthy business and a healthy society.
Well, all in, are you more optimistic or pessimistic about us being ready, willing, and able to make the changes we need to make?
I'm very optimistic. In the case of climate, I don't know if it can happen fast enough. I mean, I think that's the question. And we so clearly need public policy. And unfortunately, it's politicized, like a lot of issues today. And, you know, that doesn't bode well for being able to make rapid change and massive change. On the other hand, business isn't holding back. You know, we saw, you know, General Motors announce that they're going to go to all electric cars in what seems like a very short period of time. That was unimaginable 5 years ago, even 10 years or 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So business is leaning in here. It's not even, it's not pretty, it's not predictable, but I think we're starting to see some remarkable examples of business stepping in. And we know the consequences if business is not able to integrate kind of longer-term thinking with the short-term pressures, you know, then we end up with some of these disastrous kind of examples that I also write about, whether it's Boeing or Wells Fargo or some of these, you know, situations where we haven't had our best out of business. So it's a complicated domain, but I have reason to be real optimistic.
Well, and I think you said it well in the book, inaction is not a choice. It's time to pick up the pace of change. We all, in fact, have a role to play as investors, as consumers, as employees, as citizens. Oh, Judy Samuelson, really enjoyed having you on Breaking Banks. Any last words for our listeners or thoughts on where they can pick up your book, which I think everyone should read, The New Six New Rules of Business, Creating Real Value in a Changing World?
Well, you can Google it. That'll take you quickly to Amazon. That's always the fastest way to get the book. But you can find more about the book and all the places to buy it at the book's website, which is judysamuelson.com.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.